When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Section 11 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 8, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 4. They had often spoken of Teresa, often mentioned her in passing, and Wilhelm almost every time was minded to confess that he had offered her his heart and hand. A certain feeling which he was not able to explain restrained him. He paused and wavered, till at length Natalia, with the heavenly, modest, cheerful smile she often wore, said to him, "It seems, then, I at last must break silence, and force myself into your confidence. Why, my friend, do you keep secret from me an affair of such importance to yourself, and so closely touching my concerns? You have made my friend the offer of your hand. I do not mix uncalled in the transaction. Here are my credentials. Here is the letter which she writes to you, which she sends you through my hands." "A letter from Teresa," cried he. "Yes, mein Herr, your destiny is settled. You are happy. Let me congratulate my friend and you on your good fortune." Wilhelm spoke not, but gazed out before him. Natalia looked at him. She saw that he was pale. "Your joy is strong," continued she. "It takes the form of terror. It deprives you of the power to speak. My participation is not the less cordial that I show it you in words. I hope you will be grateful, for I may say my influence on the decision of your bride has not been small. She asked me for advice, and as it happened, by a singular coincidence, that you were here just then, I was enabled to destroy the few scruples she still entertained. Our messages went swiftly to and fro. Here is her determination. Here is the conclusion of the treaty. And now you shall read her other letters. You shall have a free, clear look into the fair heart of your Teresa." Wilhelm opened the letter, which she handed him unsealed. It contained these friendly words: "I am yours, as I am and as you know me. I call you mine, as you are and as I know you. What in ourselves, what in our connection, wedlock changes, we shall study to adjust by reason, cheerfulness, and mutual goodwill. As it is no passion, but trust and inclination, for each other that is leading us together, we run less risk than thousands of others. You will forgive me, will you not, if I still think often and kindly of my former friend? In return I will press your Felix to my heart, as if I were his mother. If you choose to share my little mansion straightway, we are lord and master there. In the meanwhile the purchase of your land might be concluded. I could wish that no new arrangements were made in it without me. I could wish at once to prove that I deserve the confidence you repose in me. Adieu, dear, dear friend, beloved bridegroom, honoured husband. Teresa clasps you to her breast with hope and joy. My friend will tell you more, will tell you all." Wilhelm, to whose mind this sheet recalled the image of Teresa with the liveliest distinctness, had now recovered his composure. While reading, thoughts had rapidly alternated within his soul. With terror he discovered in his heart the most vivid traces of an inclination to Natalia. He blamed himself, declaring every thought of that description to be madness. He represented to himself Teresa in her whole perfection. He again perused the letter. He grew cheerful, or rather, he so far regained his self-possession that he could appear cheerful. Natalia handed him the letters which had passed between Teresa and herself. "Out of Teresa's we propose extracting one or two passages." After delineating her bridegroom in her own peculiar way, Teresa thus proceeded: "Such is the notion I have formed of the man who now offers me his hand. What he thinks of himself thou shalt see by and by in the papers he has sent me, where he altogether candidly draws his own portrait. I feel persuaded that I shall be happy with him. As for rank, thou knowest what my ideas have always been on this point. Some people look on disagreement of external circumstances as a fearful thing, and cannot remedy it. I wish not to persuade anyone, I wish to act according to my own persuasion. I mean not to set others an example, nor do I act without example. It is interior disagreements only that frighten me. A frame that does not fit what it is meant to hold, much pomp and little real enjoyment, wealth and avarice, nobility and coarseness, youth and pedantry, poverty and ceremonies, These are the things which would annihilate me, however it may please the world to stamp and rate them. If I hope that we shall suit each other, the hope is chiefly founded upon this, that he resembles thee, my dear Natalia, thee whom I so highly prize and reverence. Yes, he has thy noble searching and striving for the better, whereby we of ourselves produce the good which we suppose we find. How often have I blamed thee, not in silence, for treating this or that person, for acting in this or that case, otherwise than I should have done. And yet in general the issue showed that thou wert right. When we take people, thou wouldst say, merely as they are, we make them worse. When we treat them as if they were what they should be, we improve them as far as they can be improved. To see or to act thus, I know full well is not for me. Skill, order, discipline, direction, that is my affair. I always recollect what Jarno said. Teresa trains her pupils, Natalia forms them. Nay, once he went so far as to assert that of the three fair qualities, faith, love, and hope, I was entirely destitute. Instead of faith, said he, she has penetration. Instead of love, she has steadfastness. Instead of hope, she has trust. Indeed, I will confess that, till I knew thee, I knew nothing higher in the world than clearness and prudence. It was thy presence only that persuaded, animated, conquered me. To thy fair, lofty soul I willingly give place. My friend, too, I honour on the same principle. The description of his life is a perpetual seeking without finding. Not empty seeking, but wondrous, generous seeking. He fancies others may give him what can proceed from himself alone. So, love, the clearness of my vision has not injured me on this occasion more than others. I know my husband better than he knows himself, and I value him the more. I see him, yet I see not over him. All my skill will not enable me to judge of what he can accomplish. When I think of him, his image always blends itself with thine. I know not how I have deserved to belong to two such persons. But I will deserve it by endeavouring to do my duty by fulfilling what is looked for from me. If I recollect of Lothario, vividly and daily, in the company which in thought surrounds me, I cannot want him for a moment. Oh, what a pity for this noble character, related by an error of his youth to me, that nature has related him to thee. A being such as thou, in truth, were worthier of him than I. To thee I would surrender him. Let us be to him all we can, till he find a proper wife, and then, too, let us abide together. But what shall we say to our friends? Began Natalia. Your brother does not know of it? Not a hint. Your people know as little. We women have, on this occasion, managed the affair ourselves. Lydia had put some whims into Teresa's head concerning Jarno and the Abbe. There are certain plans and secret combinations, with the general scheme of which I am acquainted, and into which I never thought of penetrating farther. With regard to these, Teresa has, through Lydia, taken up some shadow of suspicion. So in this decisive step she would not suffer any one but me to influence her. With my brother it had been already settled that they should merely announce their marriages to one another, not giving or asking counsel on the subject. Natalia wrote a letter to her brother. She invited Wilhelm to subjoin a word or two, Teresa having so desired it. They were just about to seal when Jarno unexpectedly sent up his name. His reception was, of course, as kind as possible. He wore a sportful, merry air. He could not long forbear to tell his errand. "I am come," said he, "to give you very curious and very pleasing tidings. They concern Teresa. You have often blamed us, fair Natalia, for troubling our heads about so many things. But now you see how good it is to have one's spies in every place. Guess, and let us see your skill for once." The self-complacency with which he spoke these words, the roguish mien with which he looked at Wilhelm and Natalia, persuaded both of them that he had found their secret. Natalia answered, smiling, "We are far more skilful than you think. Before we even heard your riddle, we had put the answer to it down in black and white." With these words she handed him the letter to Lothario, satisfied at having met, in this way, the little triumph and surprise he had meant for them. Jarno took the sheet with some astonishment, ran it quickly over, started, let it drop from his hands, and stared at both his friends with an expression of amazement, nay, of fright, which on his countenance was rare. He spoke no word. Wilhelm and Natalia were not a little struck. Jarno stepped up and down the room. "What shall I say?" cried he. "Or shall I say it all? But it must come out. The perplexity is not to be avoided. So secret for secret, surprise against surprise. Teresa is not the daughter of her reputed mother. The hindrance is removed. I came to ask you to prepare her for a marriage with Lothario." Jarno saw the shock which he had given his friends. They cast their eyes upon the ground. "The present case," said he, "is one of those which are worse to bear in company. What each has to consider in it, he considers best in solitude. I at least require an hour of leave." He hastened to the garden. Wilhelm followed him mechanically, yet without approaching near. At the end of an hour they were again assembled. Wilhelm opened the conversation. "Formerly," said he, "while I was living without plan or object, in a state of carelessness, or I may say of levity, friendship, love, affection, trust, came toward me with open arms, they pressed themselves upon me. But now, when I am serious, destiny appears to take another course with me. This resolution of soliciting Teresa's hand is probably the first that has proceeded altogether from myself. I laid my plan considerately, my reason fully joined in it. By the consent of that noble maiden, all my hopes were crowned. But now the strangest fate puts back my outstretched hand. Teresa reaches hers to me, but from afar, as in a dream. I cannot grasp it, and the lovely image leaves me forever. So fare thee well, thou lovely image, and all ye images of richest happiness that gathered round it." He was silent for a moment, looking out before him. Jarno was about to speak. "Let me have another word," cried Wilhelm, "for the lot is drawing which is to decide the destiny of all my life. At this moment I am aided and confirmed by the impression which Lothario's presence made upon me at the first glance, and which has ever since continued with me. That man well merits every sort of friendship and affection, and without sacrifices friendship cannot be imagined. For his sake it was easy for me to delude a hapless girl. For his sake it shall be possible for me to give away the worthiest bride. Return, relate the strange occurrence to him, and tell him what I am prepared for." "In emergencies like this," said Jarno, "I hold that everything is done, if one do nothing rashly. Let us take no step till Lothario has agreed to it. I will go to him, wait patiently for my return or for his letter." He rode away and left his friends in great disquiet. They had time to reconsider these events, to think of them maturely. It now first occurred to them that they had taken Jarno's statement simply by itself, and without inquiring into any of the circumstances. Wilhelm was not altogether free from doubts, but next day their astonishment, nay their bewilderment, arose still higher, when a messenger arriving from Teresa brought the following letter to Natalia. "Strange as it may seem, after all the letters I have sent, I am obliged to send another, begging that thou wouldst dispatch my bridegroom to me instantly. He shall be my husband, what plans soever they may lay to rob me of him. Give him the enclosed letter, only not before witnesses, whoever they may be." The enclosed letter was as follows: "What opinion will you form of your Teresa, when you see her all at once insisting passionately on a union which calm reason alone appeared to have appointed? Let nothing hinder you from setting out the moment you have read this letter. Come, my dear, dear friend. Now three times dearer, since they are attempting to deprive me of you." "What is to be done?" cried Wilhelm, after he had read the letter. "In no case that I remember," said Natalia, after some reflection, "have my heart and judgment been so dumb as in this. What to do or to advise I know not." "Can it be," cried Wilhelm vehemently, "that Lothario does not know of it? Or if he does, that he is but like us, the sport of hidden plans? As Jarno, when he saw our letter, devised that fable on the spot? Would he have told us something different if we had not been so precipitate? What can they mean? What intentions can they have? What plan can Teresa mean? Yes, it must be owned, Lothario is begirt with secret influences and combinations. I myself have found that they are active, that they take a certain charge of the proceedings, of the destiny, of several people, and contrive to guide them. The ulterior objects of these mysteries I know not, but their nearest purpose, that of snatching my Teresa from me, I perceive but too distinctly. On the one hand, this prospect of Lothario's happiness, which they exhibit to me, may be but a hollow show. On the other hand, I see my dear, my honoured bride, inviting me to her affection. What shall I do? What shall I forbear?" "A little patience," said Natalia, "a little time for thought. In these singular perplexities I know but this, that what can never be recalled should not be done in haste. To a fable, to an artful plan, we have steadfastness and prudence to oppose. Whether Jarno has been speaking true or false must soon appear. If my brother has actually hopes of a union with Teresa, it were hard to cut him off forever from that prospect at the moment when it seems so kindly inviting him. Let us wait at least till we discover whether he himself knows anything of it, whether he believes and hopes. These prudent counsels were confirmed by a letter from Lothario. I do not send Yarno, he wrote. A line from my hand is more to thee than the minutest narrative in the mouth of a messenger. I am certain Teresa is not the daughter of her reputed mother, and I cannot renounce hope of being hers till she, too, is persuaded, and can then decide between my friend and me with calm consideration. Let him not leave thee, I entreat it. The happiness, the life of a brother is at stake. I promise thee this uncertainty shall not be long. You see how the matter stands, said she to Wilhelm with a friendly air. Give me your word of honour that you will not leave the house. I give it, cried he, stretching out his hand. I will not leave this house against your will. I thank heaven and my better genius that on this occasion I am led, and led by you. Natalia wrote Teresa an account of everything, declaring that she would not let her friend away. She sent Lothario's letter also. Teresa answered, I wondered not a little that Lothario is himself convinced. To his sister he would not feign to this extent. I am vexed, greatly vexed. It is better that I say no more. But I will come to thee so soon as I have got poor Lydia settled. They are treating her cruelly. I fear we are all betrayed, and shall be so betrayed that we shall never reach the truth. If my friend were of my opinion, he would give thee the slip after all, and throw himself into the arms of his Teresa, whom none shall take away from him. But I, as I dread, shall lose him, and not regain Lothario. From the latter they are taking Lydia by showing him afar off the prospect of obtaining me. I will say no more. The entanglement will grow still deeper. Whether in the meantime these delightful positions in which we stand to each other may not be so pushed awry, so undermined and broken down, that when the darkness passes off the mischief can no longer admit of remedy, time will show. If my friend do not break away, in a few days I myself will come and seek him out beside thee, and hold him fast. Thou marvellest how this passion can have gained the mastery of thy Teresa. It is no passion, but conviction. It is a belief that, since Lothario can never be mine, this new friend will make me happy. Tell him so, in the name of the little boy that sat with him underneath the oak, and thanked him for his sympathy. Tell it him in the name of Teresa, who met his offers with a hearty openness. My first dream of living with Lothario has wandered far away from my soul. The dream of living with my other friend is yet wholly present to me. Do they hold me so light as to think that it were easy to exchange the former with the latter? I depend on you, said Natalia to Wilhelm, handing him the letter. You will not leave me. Consider that the comfort of my life is in your hands. My being is so intimately bound and interwoven with my brother's that he feels no sorrow which I do not feel, no joy which does not likewise gladden me. Nay, I may truly say, through him alone I have experienced that the heart can be affected and exalted, that in the world there may be joy, love, and an emotion which contents the soul beyond its utmost want. She stopped. Wilhelm took her hand and cried, Oh, continue! This is the time for a true mutual disclosure of our thoughts. It never was more necessary for us to be well acquainted with each other. Yes, my friend, said she, smiling with her quiet, soft, indescribable dignity. Perhaps it is not out of season if I tell you that the whole of what so many books, of what the world holds up to us and names love, has always seemed to me a fable. You have never loved, cried Wilhelm. Never or always, said Natalia. Chapter 5. During this conversation they kept walking up and down the garden, and Natalia gathered various flowers of singular forms, entirely unknown to Wilhelm, who began to ask their names and occupy himself about them. "You know not," said Natalia, "for whom I have been plucking these. I intend them for my uncle, whom we are to visit. The sun is shining even now so bright on the hall of the past. I must lead you in this moment. And I never go to it without a few of the flowers which my uncle liked particularly, in my hand. He was a peculiar man, susceptible of very strange impressions. For certain plants and animals, for certain neighbourhoods and persons, nay, for certain sorts of minerals, he had an especial love, which he was rarely able to explain. Had I not, he would often say, from youth, withstood myself, and striven to form my judgment upon wide and general principles, I had been the narrowest and most intolerable person living. For nothing can be more intolerable than circumscribed peculiarity, in one from whom a pure and suitable activity might be required. And yet he was obliged to confess that life and breath would, as it were, leave him, if he did not now and then indulge himself, not from time to time allow himself a brief and passionate enjoyment of what he could not always praise and justify. "It is not my fault," said he, "if I have not brought my inclinations and my reason into perfect harmony." On such occasions he would joke with me and say, "Natalia may be looked upon as happy while she lives. Her nature asks nothing which the world does not wish and use." So speaking, they arrived again at the house. Natalia led him through a spacious passage to a door, before which lay two granite sphinxes. The door itself was in the Egyptian fashion, somewhat narrower above than below, and its brazen leaves prepared one for a serious or even a gloomy feeling. Wilhelm was, in consequence, agreeably surprised when his expectation issued in a sentiment of pure, cheerful serenity, as he entered a hall where art and life took away all recollection of death and the grave. In the walls all around a series of proportionable arches had been hollowed out, and large sarcophaguses stood in them. Among the pillars in the intervals between them smaller openings might be seen, adorned with urns and similar vessels. The remaining spaces of the walls and vaulted roof were regularly divided, and between bright and variegated borders, within garlands and other ornaments, a multitude of cheerful and significant figures had been painted upon grounds of different sizes. The body of the edifice was covered with that fine yellow marble which passes into reddish. Clear blue stripes of a chemical substance, happily imitating azure stone, while they satisfied the eye with contrast, gave unity and combination to the whole. All this pomp and decoration showed itself in the chastest architectural forms, and thus every one who entered felt as if exalted above himself, while the cooperating products of art, for the first time, taught him what man is and what he may become. Opposite the door, on a stately sarcophagus, lay a marble figure of a noble-looking man, reclined upon a pillow. He held a roll before him and seemed to look at it with still attention. It was placed so that you could read with ease the words which stood there. "Think of living." Natalia took away a withered bunch of flowers, and laid the fresh one down before the figure of her uncle. For it was her uncle whom the marble represented. Wilhelm thought he recognized the features of the venerable gentleman whom he had seen when lying wounded in the green of the forest. "Here he and I passed many an hour," said Natalia, "while the hall was getting ready. In his latter years he had gathered several skilful artists around him, and his chief delight was to invent or superintend the drawings and cartoons for these pictures." Wilhelm could not satisfy himself with looking at the objects which surrounded him. "What a life," exclaimed he, "in this hall of the past! One might with equal justice name it the hall of the present and the future. Such all were, such all will be. There is nothing transitory but the individual who looks at and enjoys it. Here this figure of the mother pressing her infant to her bosom will survive many generations of happy mothers. Centuries hence, perhaps some father will take pleasure in contemplating this bearded man, who has laid aside his seriousness and is playing with his son. Thus shamefaced will the bride sit for ages, and amid her silent wishes need that she be comforted, that she be spoken to. Thus impatient will the bridegroom listen on the threshold whether he may enter." The figures Wilhelm was surveying with such rapture were of almost boundless number and variety. From the first jocund impulse of the child, merely to employ its every limb in sport, up to the peaceful, sequestered earnestness of the sage, you might, in fair and living order, see delineated how man possesses no capacity or tendency without employing and enjoying it. From the first soft, conscious feeling, when the maiden lingers in pulling up her pitcher, and looks with satisfaction at her image in the clear fountain, to those high solemnities when kings and nations invoke the gods at the altar to witness their alliances, all was depicted, all was forcible and full of meaning. It was a world, it was a heaven, that in this abode surrounded the spectator. And beside the thoughts which those polished forms suggested, beside the feelings they awoke, there still seemed something further to be present, something by which the whole man felt himself laid hold of. Wilhelm too observed this, though unable to account for it. "What is this," exclaimed he, "which independently of all signification, without any sympathy that human incidents and fortunes may inspire us with, acts on me so strongly and so gracefully? It speaks to me from the whole, it speaks from every part. Though I have not fully understood the former, though I do not especially apply the latter to myself, what enchantment breathes from these surfaces, these lines, these heights and breadths, these masses and colours? What is it that makes these figures so delightful, even when slightly viewed, and merely in the light of decorations? Yes, I feel it. One might tarry here, might rest, might view the whole, and be happy, and yet feel and think something altogether different from aught that stood before his eyes. And certainly, if we were able to describe how happily the whole was subdivided, how everything determined by its place, by combination or by contrast, by uniformity or by variety, appeared exactly as it should have done, producing an effect as perfect as distinct, we should transport the reader to a scene from which he would not be in haste to stir. Four large marble candelabras rose in the corners of the hall. Four smaller ones were in the midst of it, around a very beautifully worked sarcophagus, which, judging from its size, might once have held a young person of middle stature. Natalia paused beside this monument. She laid her hand upon it as she said, "My worthy uncle had a great attachment to this fine antique. It is not, he would often say, the first blossoms alone that drop. Such you can keep above in these little spaces. But fruits also, which hanging on their twigs, long give us the fairest hope, whilst a secret worm is preparing their too early ripeness and their quick decay. I fear," continued she, "his words have been prophetic of that dear little girl who seems withdrawing gradually from our cares and bending to this peaceful dwelling." As they were about to go, Natalia stopped and said, "There is something still which merits your attention. Observe these half-round openings aloft on both sides. Here the choir can stand concealed while singing. These iron ornaments below the cornice serve for fastening on the tapestry, which, by order of my uncle, must be hung around at every burial. Music, particularly song, was a pleasure he could not live without, and it was one of his peculiarities that he wished the singer not to be in view. In this respect, he would say, they spoil us at the theatre. The music there is, as it were, subservient to the eye. It accompanies movements, not emotions. In oratorios and concerts, the form of the musician constantly disturbs us. True music is intended for the ear alone. A fine voice is the most universal thing that can be figured, and while the narrow individual that uses it presents himself before the eye, he cannot fail to trouble the effect of that pure universality. The person whom I am to speak with I must see, because it is a solitary man whose form and character give worth or worthlessness to what he says. But on the other hand, whoever sings to me must be invisible. His form must not confuse me or corrupt my judgment. Here it is but one human organ speaking to another. It is not spirit speaking to spirit, not a thousandfold world to the eye, not a heaven to the man. On the same principles in respect of instrumental music, he required that the orchestra should as much as possible be hid, because by the mechanical exertions, by the mean and awkward gestures of the performers, our feelings are so much dispersed and perplexed. Accordingly, he always used to shut his eyes while hearing music, thereby to concentrate his whole being on the single pure enjoyment of the ear." They were about to leave the hall when they heard the children running hastily along the passage, and Felix crying, "No eye! No eye!" Mignon rushed in at the open door. She was foremost, but out of breath, and could not speak a word. Felix, still at some distance, shouted out, "Mamma Teresa is come!" The children had run a race, as it seemed, to bring the news. Mignon was lying in Natalia's arms. Her heart was beating vehemently. "Naughty child," said Natalia, "art thou not forbidden to make violent exertions? See how thy heart is beating." "Let it break," said Mignon with a deep sigh. "It has beat too long." They had scarcely composed themselves from this surprise, this sort of consternation, when Teresa entered. She flew to Natalia, clasped her and Mignon in her arms. Then, turning round to Wilhelm, she looked at him with her clear eyes and said, "Well, my friend, how is it with you? You have not let them cheat you?" He made a step toward her. She sprang to him and hung upon his neck. "Oh, my Teresa," cried he. "My friend, my love, my husband. Yes, forever thine," cried she amid the warmest kisses. Felix pulled her by the gown and cried, "Mamma Teresa, I am here too." Natalia stood and looked before her. Mignon on a sudden clapped her left hand on her heart, and stretching out the right arm violently, fell with a shriek at Natalia's feet, as dead. The fright was great. No motion of the heart or pulse was to be traced. Wilhelm took her on his arm, and hastily carried her away. The body hung lax over his shoulders. The presence of the doctor was of small avail. He and the young surgeon, whom we know already, strove in vain. The dear little creature could not be recalled to life. Natalia beckoned to Teresa. The latter took her friend by the hand and led him from the room. He was dumb, not uttering a word. He durst not meet her eyes. He sat down with her upon the sofa where he had first found Natalia. He thought with great rapidity along a series of fateful incidents, or rather he did not think, but let his soul be worked on by the thoughts which would not leave it. There are moments in life when past events, like winged shuttles, dart to and fro before us, and by their incessant movements weave a web which we ourselves, in a greater or less degree, have spun and put upon the loom. "My friend, my love," said Teresa, breaking silence as she took him by the hand, "let us stand together firmly in this hour, as we perhaps shall often have to do in similar hours. These are occurrences which it takes two united hearts to suffer. Think, my friend, feel that thou art not alone. Show that thou lovest thy Teresa by imparting thy sorrows to her." She embraced him and drew him softly to her bosom. He clasped her in his arms and pressed her strongly toward him. "The poor child," cried he, "used in mournful moments to seek shelter and protection in my unstable bosom. Let the stability of thine assist me in this heavy hour." They held each other fast. He felt her heart beat against his breast, but in his spirit all was desolate and void. Only the figures of Mignon and Natalia flitted like shadows across the waste of his imagination. Natalia entered. "Give us thy blessing," cried Teresa. "Let us in this melancholy moment be united before thee." Wilhelm had hid his face upon Teresa's neck. He was so far relieved that he could weep. He did not hear Natalia come. He did not see her, but at the sound of her voice his tears redoubled. "What God has joined I will not part," she answered, smiling, "but to unite you is not in my power. Nor am I gratified to see that sorrow and sympathy seem altogether to have banished from your hearts the recollection of my brother." At these words Wilhelm started from Teresa's arms. "Whither are you going?" cried the ladies. "Let me see the child," said he, "whom I have killed. Misfortune, when we look upon it with our eyes, is smaller than when our imagination sinks the evil down into the recesses of the soul. Let us view the departed angel. Her serene countenance will say to us that it is well with her." As his friends could not restrain the agitated youth, they followed him, but the worthy doctor with the surgeon met them and prevented them from coming near the dead. "Keep away from this mournful object," said he, "and allow me, so far as I am able, to give some continuance to these remains. On this dear and singular being I will now display the beautiful art, not only of embalming bodies, but of retaining in them a look of life. As I foresaw her death, the preparations are already made. With these helps I shall undoubtedly succeed. Give me but a few days, and ask not to see the child again till I have brought her to the hall of the past." The young surgeon had in his hands that well-known case of instruments. "From whom can he have got it?" Wilhelm asked the doctor. "I know it very well," replied Natalia. "He has it from his father, who dressed your wounds when we found you in the forest." "Then I have not been mistaken. I recognized the band at once," cried Wilhelm. "Oh, get it for me. It was this that first gave me any hint of my unknown benefactress. What weal and woe will such a thing survive? Beside how many sorrows has this band already been, and its threads still hold together? How many men's last moments has it witnessed, and its colours are not yet faded? It was near me in one of the fairest hours of my existence, when I lay wounded on the ground, and your helpful form appeared before me, and the child whom we are now lamenting sat with its bloody hair, busied with the tenderest care to save my life." It was not long that our friends could converse about this sad occurrence, that Teresa could inquire about the child and the probable cause of its unexpected death. For strangers were announced who, on making their appearance, proved to be well-known strangers. Lothario, Jarno, and the Abbé entered. Natalia met her brother. Among the rest there was a momentary silence. Teresa, smiling on Lothario, said, "You scarcely expected to find me here. Of course it would not have been advisable that we should visit one another at the present time. However, after such an absence, take my cordial welcome." Lothario took her hand and answered, "If we are to suffer and renounce, it may as well take place in the presence of the object whom we love and wish for. I desire no influence on your determination. My confidence in your heart, in your understanding, and clear sense is still so great that I willingly commit to your disposal my fate and that of my friend." The conversation turned immediately to general, nay, we may say, to trivial topics. The company soon separated into single pairs for walking. Natalia was with her brother, Teresa with the Abbé. Our friend was left with Jarno in the castle. The appearance of the guests at the moment when a heavy sorrow was oppressing Wilhelm had, instead of dissipating his attention, irritated him, and made him worse. He was fretful and suspicious, and unable or uncareful to conceal it, when Jarno questioned him about his sulky silence. "What is the use of saying more?" cried Wilhelm. "Lothario with his helpers is come, and it were strange if those mysterious watchmen of the tower, who are constantly so busy, did not now exert their influence upon us, to effect I know not what strange purpose. So far as I have known these saintly gentlemen, it seems to be in every case their laudable endeavour to separate the united and to unite the separated. What sort of web their weaving will produce may probably to unholy eyes be for ever a riddle. You are cross and bitter, said the other. That is as it should be. Would you get into a proper passion, it were still better. That too might come about, said Wilhelm. I fear much some of you are in the mind to load my patience, natural and acquired, beyond what it will bear. In the meantime, said the other, till we see what is to be the issue of the matter, I could like to tell you somewhat of the tower which you appear to view with such mistrust. It stands with you, said Wilhelm, whether you will risk your eloquence on an attention so distracted. My mind is so engaged at present that I know not whether I can take a proper interest in these very dignified adventures. Your pleasing humour shall not hinder me, said Jarno, from explaining this affair to you. You reckon me a clever fellow. I want to make you reckon me an honest one, and what is more, on this occasion I am bidden speak. I could wish, said Wilhelm, that you did it of yourself, and with an honest purpose to inform me. But as I cannot hear without suspicion, wherefore should I hear at all? If I have nothing better to do, said Jarno, than tell you stories, you too have time to listen to me. And to this you may perhaps feel more inclined when I assure you that all you saw in the tower was but the relics of a youthful undertaking, in regard to which the greater part of the initiated were once in deep earnest, though all of them now view it with a smile. So, with these pompous signs and words you do but mock, cried Wilhelm. With a solemn air you lead us to a place inspiring reverence by its aspect. You make the strangest visions pass before us. You give us rolls full of glorious mystic apothegms, of which, in truth, we understand but little. You disclose to us that hitherto we have been pupils. You solemnly pronounce us free, and we are just as wise as we were. Have you not the parchment by you, said the other? It contains a deal of sense. Those general apothegms were not picked up at random, though they seem obscure and empty to a man without experiences to recollect while reading them. But give me the indenture, as we call it, if it is at hand. Quite at hand, cried Wilhelm. Such an amulet well merits being worn upon one's breast. Well, said Jarno, smiling, who knows whether the contents of it may not one day find place in your head and heart? He opened the roll and glanced over the first half of it. This, said he, regards the cultivation of our gifts for arts and science, of which let others speak. The second treats of life. Here I am more at home. He then began to read passages, speaking between whiles, and connecting them with his remarks and narrative. The taste of youth for secrecy, for ceremonies, for imposing words, is extraordinary, and frequently bespeaks a certain depth of character. In those years we wish to feel our whole nature seized and moved, even though it be but vaguely and darkly. The youth who happens to have lofty aspirations and forecastings thinks that secrets yield him much, that he must depend much on secrets, and effect much by means of them. It was with such views that the abbé favoured a certain society of young men, partly according to his principle of aiding every tendency of nature, partly out of habit and inclination. For in former times he had himself been joined to an association which appears to have accomplished many things in secret. For this business I was least of all adapted. I was older than the rest. From youth I had thought clearly. I wished in all things nothing more than clearness. I felt no interest in men but to know them as they were. With the same taste I gradually infected all the best of our associates, and this circumstance had almost given a false direction to our plan of culture. For we now began to look at nothing but the errors and the narrowness of others, and to think ourselves a set of highly gifted personages. Here the abbé came to our assistance. He taught us that we never should inspect the conduct of men, unless we at the same time took an interest in improving it, and that through action only could we ever be in a condition to inspect and watch ourselves. He advised us, however, to retain the primary forms of the society. Hence there was still a sort of law in our proceedings. The first mystic impressions might be traced in the constitution of the whole. At length, as by a practical similitude, it took the form of a corporate trade whose business was the arts. Hence came the names of apprentices, assistants, and masters. We wished to see with our own eyes and to form for ourselves a special record of our own experience in the world. Hence those numerous confessions which in part we ourselves wrote, in part made others write, and out of which the several apprenticeships were afterward compiled. The formation of his character is not the chief concern with every man. Many merely wish to find a sort of recipe for comfort, directions for acquiring riches, or whatever good they aim at. All such, when they would not be instructed in their proper duties, were wont to mystify, to treat with juggleries, and every sort of hocus-pocus, and at length to shove aside. We advanced none to the rank of masters, but such as clearly felt and recognized the purpose they were born for, and had got enough of practice to proceed along their way with a certain cheerfulness and ease. "In my case, then," cried Wilhelm, "your ceremony has been very premature, for since the day when you pronounced me free, what I can, will, or shall do has been more unknown to me than ever. We are not to blame for this perplexity. Perhaps good fortune will deliver us. In the meantime, listen. He in whom there is much to be developed will be later in acquiring true perceptions of himself and of the world. There are few who at once have thought and the capacity of action. Thought expands, but lames. Action animates, but narrows." "I beg of you," cried Wilhelm, "not to read me any more of that surprising stuff. These phrases have sufficiently confused me before." "I will stick by my story, then," said Jarno, half rolling up the parchment, into which, however, he kept casting frequent glances. "I myself have been of less service to the cause of our society and of my fellow men than any other member. I am but a bad schoolmaster. I cannot bear to look on people making awkward trials. When I see a person wander from his path, I feel constrained to call to him, although it were a night walker going straight to break his neck. On this point I had a continual struggle with the abbe, who maintains that error can never be cured except by erring. About you, too, we often argued. He had taken an especial liking to you, and it is saying something to have caught so much of his attention. For me, you must admit that every time we met I told you just the naked truth." "Certainly you spared me very little," said the other, "and I think you still continue faithful to your principles." "What is the use of sparing," answered Jarno, "when a young man of many good endowments is taking a quite false direction?" "Pardon me," said Wilhelm, "you have rigorously enough denied me any talent for the stage. I confess to you that though I have entirely renounced the art, I cannot think myself entirely incapable." "And with me," said Jarno, "it is well enough decided that a person who can only play himself is no player. Whoever cannot change himself, in temper and in form, into many forms, does not deserve the name. Thus you, for example, acted Hamlet, and some other characters, extremely well, because in these your form, your disposition, and the temper of the moment suited. For an amateur theatre, for any one who saw no other way before him, this would perhaps have answered well enough. But," continued Jarno, looking on the roll, "we should guard against a talent which we cannot hope to practice in perfection. Improve it as we may, we shall always, in the end, when the merit of the master has become apparent to us, painfully lament the loss of time and strength devoted to such botching." "Do not read," cried Wilhelm. "I entreat you earnestly, speak on, tell, inform me. So the abbe aided me in Hamlet. He provided me a ghost?" "Yes, for he asserted that it was the only way of curing you, if you were curable." "And on this account he left the veil and bade me flee?" "Yes, he hoped that, having fairly acted Hamlet, your desire of acting would be satiated. He maintained that you would never go upon the stage again. I believed the contrary, and I was right. We argued on the subject that very evening when the play was over." "You saw me act, then?" "I did indeed." "And who was it that played the ghost?" "That I cannot tell you, either the abbe or his twin brother, but I think the latter, for he is a little taller." "You then have secrets from each other?" "Friends may and must have secrets from, but they are not secrets to each other." "The very thought of that perplexity perplexes me. Let me understand the man to whom I owe so many thanks as well as such reproaches." "What gives him such a value in our estimation," answered Jarno, "what in some degree secures him the dominion over all of us, is the free, sharp eye that nature has bestowed on him, for all the powers which dwell in man, and are susceptible of cultivation, each according to its kind. Most men, even the most accomplished, are but limited. Each prizes certain properties in others and himself. These alone he favours, these alone will he have cultivated. Directly the reverse is the procedure of our abbe. For every gift he has a feeling, every gift he delights to recognise and forward. But I must look into my role again. It is all men that make up mankind, all powers taken together that make up the world. These are frequently at variance, and as they endeavour to destroy each other, nature holds them together and again produces them. From the first animal tendency to handicraft attempts, up to the highest practising of intellectual art, from the inarticulate crowings of the happy infant, up to the polished utterance of the orator and singer, from the first bickerings of boys, up to the vast equipments by which countries are conquered and retained, from the slightest kindliness and the most transitory love, up to the fiercest passion and the most earnest covenant, from the merest perception of sensible presence, up to the faintest presentiments and hopes of the remotest spiritual future. All this, and much more also, lies in man, and must be cultivated, yet not in one, but in many. Every gift is valuable and ought to be unfolded. When one encourages the beautiful alone, and another encourages the useful alone, it takes them both to form a man. The useful encourages itself, for the multitude produce it, and no one can dispense with it. The beautiful must be encouraged, for few can set it forth, and many need it. "Hold, hold," cried Wilhelm, "I have read it all."
"Yet a line or two," said Jarno. "Here is our worthy abbe to a hair's breadth. One power rules another, none can cultivate another. In each endowment, and not elsewhere, lies the force which must complete it. This many people do not understand, who yet attempt to teach and influence."
"Nor do I understand it," answered Wilhelm. "You will often hear the abbe preach on this text, and therefore let us merely keep a clear and steady eye on what is in ourselves, on what endowments of our own we mean to cultivate. Let us be just to others, for we ourselves are only to be valued in so far as we can value. For heaven's sake, no more of these wise saws. I feel them to be but a sorry balsam for a wounded heart. Tell me rather, with your cruel settledness, what you expect of me, how and in what manner you intend to sacrifice me. For every such suspicion, I assure you, you will afterward beg our pardon. It is your affair to try and choose. It is ours to aid you. A man is never happy till his vague striving has itself marked out its proper limitation. It is not to me that you must look, but to the abbé. It is not of yourself that you must think, but of what surrounds you. Thus, for instance, learn to understand Lothario's superiority, how his quick and comprehensive vision is inseparably united with activity, how he constantly advances, how he expands his influence, and carries everyone along with him. Wherever he may be, he bears a world about with him. His presence animates and kindles. Observe our good physician, on the other hand. His nature seems to be directly the reverse. If the former only works upon the general whole, and at a distance, the latter turns his piercing eye upon the things that are beside him. He rather furnishes the means for being active than himself displays or stimulates activity. His conduct is exactly like the conduct of a good domestic manager. He is busied silently while he provides for each in his peculiar sphere. His knowledge is a constant gathering and expanding, a taking in and giving out on a small scale. Perhaps Lothario in a single day might overturn what the other had for years been employed in building up, but perhaps Lothario also might impart to others, in a moment, strength sufficient to restore 100-fold what he had overturned.
"It is but a sad employment," answered Wilhelm, "to contemplate the sublime advantages of others at a moment when we are at variance with ourselves. Such contemplations suit the man at ease, not him whom passion and uncertainty are agitating."
"Peacefully and reasonably to contemplate is at no time hurtful," answered Jarno, "and while we use ourselves to think of the advantages of others, our own mind comes insensibly to imitate them, and every false activity to which our fancy was alluring us is then willingly abandoned. Free your mind, if you can, from all suspicion and anxiety. Here comes the abbé. Be courteous toward him, till you have learned still further what you owe him. The rogue! There he goes between Natalia and Teresa. I could bet he is contriving something. As in general he rather likes to act the part of destiny, so he does not fail to show a taste for making matches when he finds an opportunity." Wilhelm, whose angry and fretful humour all the placid, prudent words of Jarno had not bettered, thought his friend exceedingly indelicate for mentioning marriage at a moment like the present. He answered, with a smile indeed, but a rather bitter one, "I thought the taste for making matches had been left to those that had a taste for one another."
End of section 11.
Section 12 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 2, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 8, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 6. The company had met again. The conversation of our friends was necessarily interrupted. Ere long a courier was announced, as wishing to deliver with his own hand a letter to Lothario. The man was introduced. He had a vigorous, sufficient look. His livery was rich and handsome. Wilhelm thought he knew him, nor was he mistaken, for it was the man whom he had sent to seek Filina and the fancied Mariana, and who never came back. Our friend was about to address him when Lothario, who had read the letter, asked the courier with a serious, almost angry tone, "What is your master's name?" "Of all questions," said the other with a prudent air, "this is the one which I am least prepared to answer. I hope the letter will communicate the necessary information. Verbally I have been charged with nothing."
"Be it as it will," replied Lothario with a smile. "Since your master puts such trust in me as to indite a letter so exceedingly facetious, he shall be welcome to us."
"He will not keep you long waiting for him," said the courier with a bow, and withdrew.
"Do but hear the distracted, stupid message," said Lothario. "As of all guests, good humour is believed to be the most agreeable wherever he appears, and as I always keep that gentleman beside me by way of travelling companion, I feel persuaded that the visit I intend to pay your noble lordship will not be taken ill. On the contrary, I hope the whole of your illustrious family will witness my arrival with complete satisfaction, and in due time also my departure, being always, etc., Count of Snailfoot."
"'Tis a new family," said the abbé.
"A vicariate count, perhaps," said Yarno.
"The secret is easy to unriddle," said Natalia. "I wager it is none but Brother Friedrich, who has threatened us with a visit ever since my uncle's death."
"Right, fair and skilful sister," cried a voice from the nearest thicket, and immediately a pleasant, cheerful youth stepped forward. Wilhelm could scarcely restrain a cry of wonder. "What," exclaimed he, "does our fair-haired knave, too, meet me here?" Friedrich looked attentively, and, recognizing Wilhelm, cried, "In truth, it would not have astonished me so much to have beheld the famous pyramids, which still stand fast in Egypt, or the grave of King Mausolus, which, as I am told, does not exist, here placed before me in my uncle's garden, as to find you in it, my old friend and frequent benefactor. Accept my best and heartiest service." After he had kissed and complimented the whole circle, he again sprang toward Wilhelm, crying, "Use him well, this hero, this leader of armies, and dramatical philosopher. When we became acquainted first, I dressed his hair indifferently, I may say execrably. Yet he afterwards saved me from a pretty load of blows. He is magnanimous as Scipio, munificent as Alexander. At times he is in love, yet he never hates his rivals. Far from heaping coals of fire on the heads of his enemies, a piece of service, I am told, which we can do for anyone, he rather, when his friends have carried off his love, dispatches good and trusty servants after them, that they may not strike their feet against a stone." In the same style he ran along with a volubility which baffled all attempts to restrain it, and as no one could reply to him in that vein, he had the conversation mostly to himself. "Do not wonder," cried he, "that I am so profoundly versed in sacred and profane writers. You shall hear by and by how I attained my learning." They wished to know how matters stood with him, where he had been, but crowds of proverbs and old stories choked his explanation. Natalia whispered to Teresa, "His gaiety afflicts me. I am sure at heart he is not merry." As, except a few jokes which Yarno answered, Friedrich's merriment was met by no response from those about him, he was obliged at last to say, "Well, there is nothing left for me, but among so many grave faces, to be grave myself. And as, in such a solemn scene, the burden of my sins falls heavy on my soul, I must honestly resolve upon a general confession, for which, however, you, my worthy gentlemen and ladies, shall not be a jot the wiser. This honourable friend already knows a little of my walk and conversation. He alone shall know the rest, and this the rather, as he alone has any cause to ask about it. Are not you," continued he to Wilhelm, "curious about the how and where, the when and wherefore? And how it stands with the conjugation of the Greek verb, phileo, philo, and the derivatives of that very amiable part of speech?" He then took Wilhelm by the arm and led him off, pressing him and skipping around him with the liveliest air of kindness. Scarcely had they entered Wilhelm's room when Friedrich noticed, in the window, a powder knife with the inscription, "Think of me." "You keep your valuables well laid up," said he. "This is the powder knife Filina gave you when I pulled your locks for you. I hope in looking at it you have diligently thought of that fair damsel. I assure you she has not forgotten you. If I had not long ago obliterated every trace of jealousy from my heart, I could not look on you without envy." "Talk no more of that creature," answered Wilhelm. "I confess it was a while before I could get rid of the impression which her looks and manner made on me, but that was all." "Fie, fie," cried Friedrich. "Would any one deny his dearie? You loved her as completely as a man could wish. No day passed without your giving her some present, and when a German gives, you may be sure he loves. No alternative remained for me but whisking her away from you,
And in this the little red officer at last succeeded. What, you were the officer whom we discovered with her, whom she travelled off with? Yes, said Friedrich, whom you took for Mariana. We had sport enough at the mistake. What cruelty, cried Wilhelm, to leave me in such suspense. And besides, to take the courier whom you sent to catch us into pay, said Friedrich. He is a very active fellow. We have kept him by us ever since. And the girl herself I love as desperately as ever. She has managed me in some peculiar style. I am almost in a mythologic case. Every day I tremble at the thought of being metamorphosed. But tell me, pray, said Wilhelm, where have you acquired this stock of erudition? It surprises me to hear the strange way you have assumed of speaking always with a reference to ancient histories and fables. It was by a pleasant plan, said Friedrich, that I got my learning. Filina lives with me at present. We have got a lease of an old knightly castle from the farmer in whose grant it is, and there we live, with the hobgoblins of the place, as merrily as possible. In one of the rooms we found a small but choice library, consisting of a Bible in folio, Gottfried's Chronicle, two volumes of the Theatrum Europaeum, an Acera Philologica, Griffius's writings, and some other less important works. As we now and then, when tired of romping, felt the time hang heavy on our hands, we proposed to read some books, and before we were aware the time hung heavier than ever. At last Filina hit upon the royal plan of laying all the tomes, opened at once, upon a large table. We sat down opposite to one another. We read to one another, always in detached passages, first from this book, then from that. We had a jolly time of it. We felt now as if we were in good society, where it is reckoned unbecoming to dwell on any subject, or search it to the bottom. We thought ourselves in witty, gay society, where none will let his neighbour speak. We regularly treat ourselves with this diversion every day, and the erudition we obtain from it is quite surprising. Already there is nothing new for us under the sun. On everything we see or hear, our learning offers us a hint. This method of instruction we diversify in many ways. Frequently we read by an old spoiled sandglass, which runs in a minute or two. The moment it is down, the silent party turns it round like lightning, and commences reading from his book. And no sooner is it down again than the other cuts him short and starts the former topic. Thus we study in a truly academic manner, with this difference, that our hours are shorter, and our studies extremely varied. This rioting is quite conceivable, said Wilhelm, when a pair like you two are together. But how a pair so full of frolic stay together does not seem so easily conceivable. It is our good fortune, answered Friedrich, and our bad. Filina dare not let herself be seen. She cannot bear to see herself. She is with child. Nothing ever was so ludicrous and shapeless in the world. A little while before I came away, she chanced to cast an eye upon the looking-glass in passing. "Oh," cried she, and turned away her face, "the living picture of the Frau Melina. Shocking figure. One looks entirely deplorable." "I confess," said Wilhelm with a smile, "it must be rather farcical to see a father and a mother, such as you and she, together." "'Tis a foolish business," answered Friedrich, "that I must at last be raised to the paternal dignity. But she asserts, and the time agrees. At first that cursed visit which she paid you after Hamlet gave me qualms." "What visit?" "I suppose you have not quite slept off the memory of it yet? The pretty flesh-and-blood spirit of that night, if you do not know it, was Filina. The story was, in truth, a hard dower for me. But if we cannot be content with such things, we should not be in love. Fatherhood, at any rate, depends entirely upon conviction. I am convinced, and so I am a father. There, you see, I can employ my logic in the proper season, too. And if the brat do not laugh itself to death so soon as it is born, it may prove, if not a useful, at least a pleasant citizen of this world. Whilst our friends were talking thus of mirthful subjects, the rest of the party had begun a serious conversation. Scarcely were Friedrich and Wilhelm gone, when the abbé led his friends, as if by chance, into a garden-house, and having got them seated, thus addressed them. "We have in general terms asserted that Fräulein Teresa was not the daughter of her reputed mother. It is fit that we should now explain ourselves on this matter in detail. I shall relate the story to you, which I undertake to prove and to elucidate in every point. Frau von spent the first years of her wedlock in the utmost concord with her husband. But they had this misfortune, that the children she brought him came into the world dead, and on occasion of the third, the mother was declared by the physicians to be on the verge of death, and to be sure of death if she should ever have another. The parties were obliged to take their resolution. They would not break the marriage. It was too suitable to both in a civil point of view. Frau von sought in the culture of her mind, in a certain habit of display, in the joys of vanity, a compensation for the happiness of motherhood, which was refused her. She cheerfully indulged her husband when she noticed in him an attachment to a young lady who had sole charge of their household, a person of beautiful exterior and very solid character. Frau von herself, ere long, assisted in procuring an arrangement by which the lady yielded to the wishes of Teresa's father, continuing to discharge her household duties and testifying to the mistress of the family, if possible, a more submissive zeal to serve her than before. After a while she declared herself with child, and both the father and his wife, on this occasion, though from very different causes, fell upon the same idea. Herr von wished to have the offspring of his mistress educated in the house as his lawful child, and Frau von, angry that the indiscretion of her doctor had allowed some whisper of her condition to go abroad, proposed by a supposititious child to counteract this, and likewise to retain, by such compliance, the superiority in her household which otherwise she was like to lose. However, she was more backward than her husband. She observed his purpose and contrived, without any formal question, to facilitate his explanation. She made her own terms, obtaining almost everything that she required, and hence the will in which so little care was taken of the child. The old doctor was dead. They applied to a young, active, and discreet successor. He was well rewarded. He looked forward to the credit of exposing and remedying the unskilfulness and premature decision of his deceased colleague. The true mother not unwillingly consented. They managed the deception very well. Teresa came into the world and was surrendered to a stepmother, while her mother fell a victim to the plot, having died by venturing out too early, and left the father inconsolable. Frau von had thus attained her object. In the eyes of the world she had a lovely child, which she paraded with excessive vanity, and she had also been delivered from a rival whose fortune she envied, and whose influence, at least in prospect, she beheld with apprehension. The infant she loaded with her tenderness, and by affecting in trustful hours a lively feeling for her husband's loss, she gained a mastery of his heart, so that in a manner he surrendered all to her, laid his own happiness and that of his child in her hands. Nor was it till a short while prior to his death, and in some degree by the exertions of his grown-up daughter, that he again assumed the rule in his own house. This, fair Teresa, was in all probability the secret which your father, in his last sickness, so struggled to communicate. This is what I wished to lay circumstantially before you, at a moment when our young friend, who by a strange concurrence has become your bridegroom, happens to be absent. Here are the papers which will prove in the most rigorous manner everything that I have stated. You will also see from them how long I have been following the trace of this discovery, though till now I could never attain certainty respecting it. I did not risk imparting to my friend the possibility of such a happiness. It would have wounded him too deeply had this hope a second time deceived him. You will understand poor Lydia's suspicions. I readily confess, I nowise favoured our friend's attachment to her, when I began again to look forward to his union with Teresa. To this recital no one replied. The ladies, some days afterwards, returned the papers, not making any further mention of them. There were other matters in abundance to engage the party when they were together, and the scenery around was so delightful that our friends, singly or in company, on horseback, in carriages, or on foot, delighted to explore it. On one of these excursions, Jarno took an opportunity of opening the affair to Wilhelm. He delivered him the papers, not, however, seeming to require from him any resolution in regard to them. "In this most singular position in which I am," said our friend, "I need only repeat to you what I said at first, in presence of Natalia, and with the clear intention to fulfil it. Lothario and his friends may require of me every sort of self-denial. I here abandon in their favour all pretension to Teresa. Do you procure me in return a formal discharge? There requires no great reflection to decide. For some days I have noticed that Teresa has to make an effort in retaining any show of the vivacity with which she welcomed me at first. Her affection is gone from me, or rather I have never had it." "Such affairs are more conveniently explained," said Jarno, "by a gradual process, in silence and expectation, than by many words, which always cause a sort of fermentation and embarrassment." "I rather think," said Wilhelm, "that precisely this affair admits of the most clear and calm decision on the spot. I have often been reproached with hesitation and uncertainty. Why will you now, when I do not hesitate, commit against myself the fault you have often blamed in me? Do people take such trouble with our training only to let us feel that they themselves will not be trained? Yes, grant me soon the cheerful thought that I am out of a mistaken project, into which I entered with the purest feelings in the world. Notwithstanding this request, some days elapsed without his hearing any more of the affair, or observing any further alteration in his friends. The conversation, on the contrary, was general and of indifferent matters. Chapter 7. Jarno and Wilhelm were sitting one day by Natalia. "You are thoughtful, Jarno," said the lady. "I have seen it in your looks for some time." "I am so," answered Jarno. "A weighty business is before me, which we have for years been meditating, and must now begin to execute. You already know the outline of it. I may speak of it before our friend, for it will depend on himself whether he, too, shall not share in it. You are going to get rid of me before long. I mean to take a voyage to America." "To America," said Wilhelm, smiling. "Such an adventure I did not anticipate from you, still less that you would have selected me for a companion." "When you rightly understand our plan," said Jarno, "you will give it a more honourable name, and, perhaps, yourself be tempted to embark in it. Listen to me. It requires but a slight acquaintance with the business of the world to see that mighty changes are at hand, that property is almost nowhere quite secure." "Of the business of the world I have no clear notion," interrupted Wilhelm, "and it is but of late that I ever thought about my property. Perhaps I had done well to drive it out of my head still longer. The care of securing it appears to give us hypochondria." "Hear me out," said Jarno. "Care beseems ripe age, that youth may live, for a time, free from care. In the conduct of poor mortals, equilibrium cannot be restored except by contraries. As matters go, it is anything but prudent to have property in only one place, to commit your money to a single spot, and yet it is difficult to guide it well in many. We have therefore thought of something else. From our old tower there is a society to issue, which must spread itself through every quarter of the world, and to which members from every quarter of the world shall be admissible. We shall ensure a competent subsistence to each other, in the single case of a revolution happening, which might drive any part of us entirely from their possessions. I am now proceeding to America to profit by the good connections which our friend established while he stayed there. The abbé means to go to Russia. If you like to join us, you shall have the choice of continuing in Germany to help Lothario, or of accompanying me. I conjecture you will choose the latter. To take a distant journey is extremely serviceable to a young man." Wilhelm thought a moment and replied, "The offer well deserves consideration, for ere long the word with me must be, the farther off the better. You will let me know your plan, I hope, more perfectly. It is perhaps my ignorance of life that makes me think so, but such a combination seems to me to be attended with insuperable difficulties." "The most of which till now have been avoided," answered Jarno, "by the circumstance that we have been but few in number, honourable, discreet, determined people, animated by a certain general feeling, out of which alone the feeling proper for societies can spring." "And if you speak me fair," said Friedrich, who hitherto had only listened, "I too will go along with you." Jarno shook his head. "Well, what objections can you make?" cried Friedrich. "In a new colony, young colonists will be required. These I bring with me. Merry colonists will also be required. Of these I make you certain. Besides, I recollect a certain damsel who is out of place on this side of the water, the fair, soft-hearted Lydia. What is the poor thing to do with her sorrow and mourning, unless she get an opportunity to throw it to the bottom of the sea, unless some brave fellow take her by the hand? You, my benefactor," said he, turning toward Wilhelm, "you have a taste for comforting forsaken persons. What withholds you now? Each of us might take his girl under his arm and trudge with Jarno." This proposal struck Wilhelm offensively. He answered with affected calmness, "I know not whether she is unengaged, and as in general I seem to be unfortunate in courtship, I shall hardly think of making the attempt." "Brother Friedrich," said Natalia, "though thy own conduct is so full of levity, it does not follow that such sentiments will answer others. Our friend deserves a heart that shall belong to him alone, that shall not, at his side, be moved by recollections of some previous attachment. It was only with a character as pure and reasonable as Therese's that such a venture could be risked." "Risk," cried Friedrich. "In love it is all risk. In the grove or at the altar, with a clasp of the arms or a golden ring, by the chirping of the cricket or the sound of trumpets and kettle drums, it is all but a risk. Chance does it all." I have often noticed, said Natalia, that our principles are just a supplement to our peculiar manner of existence. We delight to clothe our errors in the garb of universal laws, to attribute them to irresistibly appointed causes. Do but think by what a path thy dear will lead thee, now that she has drawn thee toward her, and holds thee fast there. She herself is on a very pretty path, said Friedrich, on the path to saintship. A bypath, it is true, and somewhat roundabout, but the pleasanter and surer for that. Maria of Magdala travelled it, and who can say how many more? But on the whole, sister, when the point in hand is love, thou shouldst not mingle in it. In my opinion, thou wilt never marry till a bride is lacking somewhere. In that case, thou wilt give thyself, with thy habitual charity, to be the supplement of some peculiar manner of existence, not otherwise. So let us strike a bargain with this soul-broker, and agree about our travelling company. You come too late with your proposals, answered Jarno. Lydia is disposed of. And how? Cried Friedrich. I myself have offered her my hand, said Jarno. Old gentleman, said Friedrich, you have done a feat to which, if we regard it as a substantive, various adjectives might be appended, various predicates if we regard it as a subject. I must honestly confess, replied Natalia, it appears a dangerous experiment to make a helpmate of a woman at the very moment when her love for another man is like to drive her to despair. I have ventured, answered Jarno, under a certain stipulation she is to be mine. And believe me, there is nothing in the world more precious than a heart susceptible of love and passion. Whether it has loved, whether it still loves, are points which I regard not. The love of which another is the object charms me almost more than that which is directed to myself. I see the strength, the force of a tender soul, and my self-love does not trouble the delightful vision. Have you then talked with Lydia of late? Inquired Natalia. Jarno smiled and nodded. Natalia shook her head, and said as she rose, I really know not what to make of you, but me you shall not mystify, I promise you. She was about retiring when the abbé entered with a letter in his hand. Stay, if you please, said he to her. I have a proposal here respecting which your counsel will be welcome. The Marchese, your late uncle's friend, whom for some time we have been expecting, will be here in a day or two. He writes to me that German is not so familiar to him as he had supposed, that he needs a person who possesses this and other languages to travel with him, that as he wishes to connect himself with scientific rather than political society, he cannot do without some such interpreter. I can think of no one better suited for the post than our young friend here. He knows the language, is acquainted with many things beside, and for himself it cannot but be advantageous to travel over Germany in such society and such circumstances. Till we have seen our native country, we have no scale to judge of other countries by. What say you, my friend? What say you, Natalia? Nobody objected to the scheme. Jarno seemed to think his transatlantic project would not be a hindrance, as he did not mean to sail directly. Natalia did not speak, and Friedrich uttered various saws about the uses of travel. This new project so provoked our friend that he could hardly conceal his irritation. He saw in this proposal a concerted plan for getting rid of him as soon as possible, and what was worse, they went so openly to work, and seemed so utterly regardless of his feelings. The suspicions Lydia had excited in him, all that he himself had witnessed, rose again upon his mind. The simple manner in which everything had been explained by Jarno now appeared to him another piece of artifice. He constrained himself and answered, "At all events, the offer will require mature deliberation." "A quick decision may perhaps be necessary," said the abbé. "For that I am not prepared," answered Wilhelm. We can wait till the Marchese comes, and then observe if we agree together. One condition must, however, be conceded first of all, that I take Felix with me. This is a condition, said the abbé, which will scarcely be conceded. And I do not see, cried Wilhelm, why I should let any man prescribe conditions to me, or why, if I choose to view my native country, I must go in company with an Italian. "Because a young man," said the abbé with a certain imposing earnestness, "is always called upon to form connections." Wilhelm, feeling that he could not long retain his self-command, as it was Natalia's presence only which, in some degree, assuaged his indignation, hastily made answer, "Give me a little while to think. I imagine it will not be very hard to settle whether I am called upon to form additional connections, or ordered irresistibly, by heart and head, to free myself from such a multiplicity of bonds, which seemed to threaten me with a perpetual miserable thraldom. Thus he spoke, with a deeply agitated mind. A glance at Natalia somewhat calmed him. Her form and dignity, in this impassioned moment, stamped themselves more deeply on his mind than ever. "Yes," said he, so soon as he was by himself, "confess it, thou lovest her. Thou once more feelest what it means to love with thy whole soul. Thus did I love Mariana, and deceive myself so dreadfully. I loved Felina, and could not help despising her. Aurelia I respected, and could not love. Teresa I reverenced, and paternal tenderness assumed the form of an affection for her. And now, when all the feelings that can make a mortal happy meet within my heart, now am I compelled to flee. Ah, why should these feelings and convictions be combined with an insuperable longing? Why, without the hope of its fulfilment, should they utterly subvert all other happiness? Shall the sun and the world, society or any other gift of fortune, ever henceforth yield me pleasure? Wilt thou not for ever say, Natalia is not here? And yet, alas, Natalia will be always present to thee. If thou closest thy eyes, she will appear to thee. If thou openest them, her form will flit before all outward things, like the image which a dazzling object leaves behind it in the eye. Did not the swiftly passing figure of the Amazon dwell continually in thy imagination? And yet thou hadst but seen her, thou didst not know her. Now when thou knowest her, when thou hast been so long beside her, when she has shown such care about thee, now are her qualities impressed as deeply upon thy soul as her form was then upon thy fancy. It is painful to be always seeking, but far more painful to have found and to be forced to leave. What now shall I ask for further in the world? What now shall I look for further? Is there a country, a city, that contains a treasure such as this? And I must travel on, and ever find inferiority. Is life then like a race-course, where a man must rapidly return when he has reached the utmost end? Does the good, the excellent, stand before us like a firm unmoving goal, from which with fleet horses we are forced away the instant we appear to have attained it? Happier are they who strive for earthly wares. They find what they are seeking in its proper climate, or they buy it in the fair. Come, my darling boy, cried he to Felix, who now ran frisking toward him. Be thou and remain thou all to me. Thou wert given me as a compensation for thy loved mother. Thou wert to replace the second mother whom I meant for thee, and now thou hast a loss still greater to make good. Occupy my heart, occupy my spirit, with thy beauty, thy loveliness, thy capabilities, and thy desire to use them. The boy was busied with a new plaything. His father tried to put it in a better state for him. Just as he succeeded, Felix had lost all pleasure in it. Thou art a true son of Adam, cried Wilhelm. Come, my child. Come, my brother, let us wander, playing without object, through the world, as we best may. His resolution to remove, to take the boy along with him, and recreate his mind by looking at the world, had now assumed a settled form. He wrote to Werner for the necessary cash and letters of credit, sending Friedrich's courier on the message, with the strictest charges to return immediately. Much as the conduct of his other friends had grieved him, his relation to Natalia remained serene and clear as ever. He confided to her his intention. She took it as a settled thing that he would go, and if this seeming carelessness in her chagrined him, her kindly manner and her presence made him calm. She counselled him to visit various towns, that he might get acquainted with certain of her friends. The courier returned and brought the letter which our friend required, though Werner did not seem content with this new whim. "My hope that thou wert growing reasonable," so the letter ran, "is now again deferred. Where are you all gadding? And where lingers the lady who thou saidst was to assist us in arranging these affairs? Thy other friends are also absent. They have thrown the whole concern upon the shoulders of the lawyer and myself. Happy that he is as expert a jurist as I am a financier, and that both of us are used to business. Fare thee well. Thy aberrations shall be pardoned thee, since but for them our situation here could not have been so favourable." So far as outward matters were concerned, Wilhelm might now have ended on his journey. But there were still for his heart two hindrances that held him fast. In the first place, they flatly refused to show him Mignon's body till the funeral the abbé meant to celebrate, and for this solemnity the preparations were not ready. There had also been a curious letter from the country clergyman, in consequence of which the doctor had gone off. It related to the harper, of whose fate Wilhelm wanted to have further information. In these circumstances, day or night, he found no rest for mind or body. When all were asleep, he wandered up and down the house. the presence of the pictures and statues, which he knew so well of old, alternately attracted and repelled him. Nothing that surrounded him could he lay hold of or let go. All things reminded him of all. The whole ring of his existence lay before him, but it was broken into fragments, and seemed as if it would never unite again. These works of art, which his father had sold, appeared to him an omen that he himself was destined never to obtain a lasting, calm possession of anything desirable in life, or always to be robbed of it so soon as gained, by his own or other people's blame. He waded so deep in these strange and dreary meditations that often he almost thought himself a disembodied spirit. And even when he felt and handled things without him, he could scarcely keep himself from doubting whether he was really there and alive. Nothing but the piercing grief which often seized him, but the tears he shed at being forced, by causes frivolous as they were irresistible, to leave the good which he had found, and found after having lost it, restored him to the feeling of his earthly life. It was in vain to call before his mind his happy state in other respects. "All is nothing, then," exclaimed he, "if the one blessing, which appears to us worth all the rest, is wanting." The abbé told the company that the Marchese was arrived. "You have determined, it appears," said he to Wilhelm, "to set out upon your travels with your boy alone. Get acquainted with this nobleman, however. He will be useful to you if you meet him by the way." The Marchese entered. He was a person not yet very far advanced in years, a fine, handsome, pleasing Lombard figure. In his youth, while in the army and afterward in public business, he had known Lothario's uncle. They had subsequently travelled through the greater part of Italy together, and many of the works of art, which the Marchese now again fell in with, had been purchased in his presence, and under various happy circumstances, which he still distinctly recollected. The Italians have in general a deeper feeling for the high dignity of art than any other nation. In Italy, whoever follows the employment tries to pass at once for artist, master, and professor, by which pretensions he acknowledges at least that it is not sufficient merely to lay hold of some transmitted excellency, or to acquire by practice some dexterity, but that a man who aims at art should have the power to think of what he does, to lay down principles, and make apparent to himself and others how and wherefore he proceeds in this way or in that. The stranger was affected at again beholding these productions when the owner of them was no more, and cheered to see the spirit of his friend surviving in the gifted persons left behind him. They discussed a series of works. They found a lively satisfaction in the harmony of their ideas. The Marchese and the Abbé were the speakers. Natalia felt herself again transported to the presence of her uncle, and could enter without difficulty into their opinions and criticisms. Wilhelm could not understand them, except as he translated their technology into dramatic language. Friedrich's facetious vein was sometimes rather difficult to keep in check. Jarno was seldom there. It being observed that excellent works of art were very rare in latter times, it was remarked by the Marchese, "We can hardly think or estimate how many circumstances must combine in favour of the artist. With the greatest genius, with the most decisive talent, the demands which he must make upon himself are infinite. The diligence required in cultivating his endowments is unspeakable. Now, if circumstances are not in his favour, if he observe that the world is very easy to be satisfied, requiring but a slight, pleasing, transitory show, it were matter of surprise if indolence and selfishness did not keep him fixed at mediocrity. It were strange if he did not rather think of bartering modish wares for gold and praises than of entering on the proper path, which could not fail in some degree to lead him to a sort of painful martyrdom. Accordingly, the artists of our time are always offering and never giving. They always aim at charming, and they never satisfy. Everything is merely indicated. You can nowhere find foundation or completion. Those for whom they labour, it is true, are little better. If you wait a while in any gallery of pictures, and observe what works attract the many, what are praised and what neglected, you have little pleasure in the present, little hope in the future." "Yes," replied the abbé, "and thus it is that artists and their judges mutually form each other. The latter ask for nothing but a general, vague enjoyment. A work of art is to delight them almost as a work of nature. They imagine that the organs for enjoying works of art may be cultivated altogether of themselves, like the tongue and the palate. They try a picture or a poem as they do an article of food. They do not understand how very different a species of culture it requires to raise one to the true enjoyment of art. The hardest part of it, in my opinion, is that sort of separation which a man that aims at perfect culture must accomplish in himself. It is on this account that we observe so many people partially cultivated, and yet every one of them attempting to pronounce upon the general whole." "'Your last remark is not quite clear to me,' said Yarno, who came in just then. "'It would be difficult,' replied the abbé, "'to explain it fully without a long detail. "'Thus much I may say. "'When any man pretends to mix in manifold activity or manifold enjoyment, "'he must also be enabled, as it were, "'to make his organs manifold and independent of each other. "'Whoever aims at doing or enjoying all and everything with his entire nature, "'whoever tries to link together all that is without him by such a species of enjoyment, "'will only lose his time in efforts that can never be successful. "'How difficult, though it seems so easy, "'is it to contemplate a noble disposition, "'a fine picture, simply in and for itself, "'to watch the music for the music's sake, "'to admire the actor in the actor, "'to take pleasure in a building for its own peculiar harmony and durability. "'Most men are wont to treat a work of art, "'though fixed and done, as if it were a piece of soft clay.' The hard and polished marble is again to mould itself, the firm-walled edifice is to contract or to expand itself, according as their inclinations, sentiments, and whims may dictate. The picture is to be instructive, the play to make us better. Everything is to do all. The reason is that most men are themselves uninformed. They cannot give themselves and their being any certain shape, and thus they strive to take from other things their proper shape, that all they have to do with may be loose and wavering like themselves. Everything is, in the long run, reduced by them to what they call effect. Everything is relative, say they. And so indeed it is. Everything with them grows relative, except absurdity and platitude, which truly are absolute enough. I understand you, answered Yarno, or rather I perceive how what you have been saying follows from the principles you hold so fast by. Yet with men, poor devils, we should not go to quest so strictly. I know enow of them in truth, who, beside the greatest works of art and nature, forthwith recollect their own most paltry insufficiency, who take their conscience and their morals with them to the opera, who bethink them of their loves and hatreds in contemplating a colonnade. The best and greatest that can be presented to them from without, they must first, as far as possible, diminish in their way of representing it, that they may in any measure be enabled to combine it with their own sorry nature. Chapter 8. The abbé called them in the evening to attend the exequies of Mignon. The company proceeded to the hall of the past. They found it magnificently ornamented and illuminated. The walls were hung with azure tapestry almost from ceiling to floor, so that nothing but the friezes and socles, above and below, were visible. On the four candelabras in the corner large wax lights were burning. Smaller lights were in the four smaller candelabras placed by the sarcophagus in the middle. Near this stood four boys, dressed in azure with silver. They had broad fans of ostrich feathers, which they waved above a figure that was resting upon the sarcophagus. The company sat down. Two invisible choruses began in a soft, musical recitative to ask, "'Whom bring ye us to the still dwelling?' The four boys replied with lovely voices, "'Tis a tired playmate whom we bring you. Let her rest in your still dwelling, till the songs of her heavenly sisters once more awaken her.' Chorus. Firstling of youth in our circle, we welcome thee, with sadness welcome thee. May no boy, no maiden, follow. Let age only, willing and composed, approach the silent hall, and in the solemn company repose this one dear child. Boys. Ah, reluctantly we brought her hither. Ah, and she is to remain here. Let us too remain. Let us weep upon her bier. Chorus. Yet look at the strong wings, look at the light, clear robe, how glitters the golden band upon her head, look at the beautiful, the noble repose. Boys. Ah, the wings do not raise her, in the frolic game her robe flutters to and fro no more. When we bound her head with roses, her looks on us were kind and friendly. Chorus. Cast forward the eye of the spirit. Awake in your souls the imaginative power which carries forth what is fairest, what is highest, life, away beyond the stars. Boys. But ah, we find her not here, in the garden she wanders not, the flowers of the meadow she plucks no longer. Let us weep, we are leaving her here. Let us weep, and remain with her. Chorus. Children, turn back into life. Your tears let the fresh air dry, which plays upon the rushing water. Flee from night. Day and pleasure and continuance are the lot of the living. Boys. Up! Turn back into life. Let the day give us labour and pleasure, till the evening brings us rest and the nightly sleep refreshes us. Chorus. Children, hasten into life. In the pure garments of beauty, may love meet you with heavenly looks and with the wreath of immortality. The boys had retired. The abbé rose from his seat and went behind the bier. It is the appointment, said he, of the man who prepared this silent abode, that each new tenant of it shall be introduced with a solemnity. After him, the builder of this mansion, the founder of this establishment, we have next brought a young stranger hither. And thus already does this little space contain two altogether different victims of the rigorous, arbitrary, and inexorable death goddess. By appointed laws we enter into life. The days are numbered which make us ripe to see the light, but for the duration of our life there is no law. The weakest thread will spin itself to unexpected length, and the strongest is cut suddenly asunder by the scissors of the fates, delighting, as it seems, in contradictions. Of the child whom we have here committed to her final rest, we can say but little. It is still uncertain whence she came. Her parents we know not. The years of her life we can only conjecture. Her deep and closely shrouded soul allowed us scarce to guess at its interior movements. There was nothing clear in her, nothing open but her affection for the man who had snatched her from the hands of a barbarian. This impassioned tenderness, this vivid gratitude, appeared to be the flame which consumed the oil of her life. The skill of the physician could not save that fair life, the most anxious friendship could not lengthen it. But if art could not stay the departing spirit, it has done its utmost to preserve the body and withdraw it from decay. A balsamic substance has been forced through all the veins, and now tinges, in place of blood, these cheeks too early faded. Come near, my friends, and view this wonder of art and care. He raised the veil. The child was lying in her angel's dress, as if asleep, in the most soft and graceful posture. They approached, and admired this show of life. Wilhelm alone continued sitting in his place. He was not able to compose himself. What he felt he durst not think, and every thought seemed ready to destroy his feeling. For the sake of the Marchese, the speech had been pronounced in French. That nobleman came forward with the rest, and viewed the figure with attention. The abbé thus proceeded. With a holy confidence, this kind heart, shut up to men, was continually turned to its God. Humility, nay, an inclination to abase herself externally, seemed natural to her. She clave with zeal to the Catholic religion, in which she had been born and educated. Often she expressed a still wish to sleep on consecrated ground. And according to the usage of the Church, we have therefore consecrated this marble coffin, and the little earth which is hidden in the cushion that supports her head. With what ardour did she, in her last moments, kiss the image of the Crucified, which stood beautifully figured on her tender arm, with many hundred points. So saying, he stripped up her right sleeve, and a crucifix, with marks and letters round it, showed itself in blue upon the white skin. The Marchese looked at this with eagerness, stooping down to view it more intensely. "O God," cried he, as he stood upright and raised his hands to heaven. "Poor child, unhappy niece, do I meet thee here? What a painful joy to find thee, whom we had long lost hope of, to find this dear frame, which we had long believed the prey of fishes in the ocean, here preserved, though lifeless. I assist at thy funeral, splendid in its external circumstances, still more splendid from the noble persons who attend thee to thy place of rest. And to these," added he with a faltering voice, "as soon as I can speak, I will express my thanks." Tears hindered him from saying more. By the pressure of a spring, the abbé sank the body into the cavity of the marble. Four youths, dressed as the boys had been, came out from behind the tapestry, and lifting the heavy, beautifully ornamented lid upon the coffin, thus began their song. The youths. Well is the treasure now laid up, the fair image of the past. Here sleeps it in the marble, undecaying. In your hearts, too, it lives, it works. Travel, travel back into life. Take along with you this holy earnestness, for earnestness alone makes life eternity. The invisible chorus joined in with the last words, but no one heard the strengthening sentiment. All were too much busied with themselves, and the emotions which these wonderful disclosures had excited. The abbé and Natalia conducted the Marchese out. Teresa and Lothario walked by Wilhelm. It was not till the music had altogether died away that their sorrows, thoughts, meditations, curiosity again fell on them with all their force and made them long to be transported back into that exalting scene. End of section 12.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.